Word. We're continuing our study in the Psalms, and we're in Psalm 105 tonight. We're going to study Psalm 105 tonight, and Lord willing, we'll look at 106 on Sunday morning. For those of you who are kind of trying to keep up in your workbooks, you might make a note on Psalm 109 that we're going to skip that. If we don't skip one or two, we won't be able to finish up by the end of the quarter. So we'll skip 109, which is an imprecatory psalm that's a lot like Psalm 69 that we already studied. But Psalm 105 tonight and 106 on Sunday, Lord willing. And then we'll do 110, 111, and 112 in succession. The 105th psalm is one of several psalms that starts with the phrase, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord." And while it's not classically identified as one of the Thanksgiving Psalms, there's certainly a lot of Thanksgiving in it. The occasion that prompted this particular psalm to be written is also, ironically, found in 1 Chronicles chapter 16. You might remember the last psalm that we studied, if you can remember, 4 days ago or 3 days ago, Psalm 96, was also written on this same occasion. What happens in that text that we talked about the other day? The ark is returned. Yeah, the ark is returned, or not returned, but brought to Jerusalem by David, and big ceremony and hoopla and all of that sort of thing. And there's a great cause for rejoicing. If you go to 1 Chronicles chapter 16, we noted verse 25 and following is basically Psalm 96. But if you back up to verse 8 and following down to about verse 24 or so, that's the middle part of Psalm 105. So what you've got is Psalm 96 and Psalm 105 were basically, the meat of them at least, were written word for word on this occasion. And then whether before or after, they're broken up to form different psalms in the book of Psalms. I think that's pretty interesting. But the occasion of this psalm being written then is one of great thanksgiving to the Lord. And we'll see as we go through this psalm, there's an acknowledgement of His goodness, the way that He keeps His covenant especially is going to be emphasized. In fact, it's the main point of the psalm. And considering the fact that you've got the ark being brought back with the tables of the covenant in it and all that sort of thing, I think that's all very, very significant. Psalm 105 and Psalm 106 are historical psalms. I love texts of Scripture that are like this, where you have a lot of history behind you, and then by inspiration, God inspires a Bible writer to give you a synopsis of history. You find those valuable? I think about maybe we're more familiar with Acts chapter 7, and Stephen just kind of goes through the whole history of Israel in one chapter, and it's a synopsis of the whole thing, how valuable that is, and how it sort of helps you see it all in one piece. Well, that's really what Psalm 105 and 106 do for us. They're very historical. They go through Psalm 105 basically from the time of Abraham to the time of the inheritance of the land. Many hundreds of years there, encapsulated in this one psalm. So we're going to be talking a lot about Old Testament history in that time period as we go through this psalm tonight. But it's more than just a point of telling history. Even as a preacher today, our Bible class teacher might go back and talk about some long period of history in the Old Testament, or even history of the New Testament, and then really just try to make one point from that history. That's really what happens in this particular psalm. It takes us through this long expanse of time from Abraham to the inhabiting of the land, inheriting Canaan, and it makes this one point that God is a covenant keeper. That God keeps His covenant. If He makes a covenant, He's going to keep His covenant. And He's going to make sure that He keeps His end of the bargain. And it's wonderfully encouraging to us who live under the new covenant of Jesus Christ to realize what a determined covenant keeper God is. And I think you'll see in tonight's lesson some things that really help us appreciate God's determination to keep His end of the bargain. And as we go through the lesson tonight, you're going to see an awful lot of things that God did, purposely did, that we might think of as accidents of history or things that just happened. But these are things that were accomplished by God so that He could keep His covenant with Abraham and with the children of Israel. So those are some of the things we'll be looking at as we go through Psalm 105 tonight. The key historical fact of Psalm 105 is that God fulfilled His promise to Abraham to give to his descendants the land of Canaan. I'm going to read, we'll go through most of this psalm verse by verse a little later, but I'm going to read verses 8 through 11 of Psalm 105 right now. It says, "He remembers His covenant forever, the word which He commanded for 1,000 generations, the covenant which He made with Abraham and His oath with Isaac, and confirmed it to Jacob for a statute, to Israel as an everlasting covenant, saying, 'To you I will give the land of Canaan as the allotment of your inheritance,' when they were few in number, indeed very few, and strangers in it." So God made a covenant with Abraham. He confirmed it with an oath to Isaac, confirmed it as well to Jacob. When we go back into Genesis, the first mention, really, implication of a land promise is given there in Genesis chapter 12. You sort of have the nation, land, and seed promises given there. But then when you get to Genesis chapter 17, really when the covenant is made and the sign of the covenant, which is circumcision, is given there in Genesis chapter 17. You may remember that. Let's go look at that just for a minute. And I want to show you these the covenant being made and the reaffirmations of it that were given to Isaac and Jacob as well. In Genesis chapter 17, and I know this is really familiar to to many of us. Sorry, I'm fumbling with my notes up here for a second. Genesis chapter 17. Not to read the whole context, but in verse 7, "I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you and their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants. And I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." So here is the covenant agreement that God made with Abraham. You can see as you go through this whole text, the covenant being made and ratified between God and Abraham, and all of that occurring. And then you can go over to chapter 26 of Genesis and verse 2. I'm sorry. Yeah. He says in verse 4, "I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of the heavens. I will give to your descendants all these lands and your seed all the nations of the earth, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." This is when he's talking to Isaac on this occasion to reaffirm that covenant. And then look over at Genesis chapter 28 in verse 10, where now he's going to talk to Jacob. "Jacob went from Beersheba and went toward Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones for that place and put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven, and there were the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, 'I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. And your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth.'" So he repeats the other promises as well. But in the context of Psalm 105, what we're told is God made this land covenant with Abraham. He reaffirmed it to Isaac and Jacob. And so we just read the verses where that happened. So we all know that as a fact of history. Very important fact of history. In fact, I've often thought, if you take Genesis 12 and Genesis 17 and the promises that were made there, it's really an outline of the whole Bible. You have the nation promise, the land promise, and the seed promise. And if you think about what God was really saying that He was going to do and bring about through the nation of Israel, make them a nation, but through their seed, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. That's the whole scheme of redemption right there in sort of a general outline form. And so those promises and the fulfillment of those promises really is what the whole rest of the Bible is about. And if you get that in your head and see that it's a story, a continuum, I think that's what we're trying to do in our classes here as we go through the 17 Bible periods to see that all of that is connected together and it flows. And these promises that are referred to in the 105th Psalm, this one promise, this land promise, is a key component of all of that. Now, so that's probably the main point. It is the main point of the 105th Psalm. The Psalm provides a great biblical response to the argument of premillennialists that the land promise made to Abraham has yet to be fulfilled. If you look at Psalm 105, look at the end of it now. We saw this covenant made by God, and God's presented to us as a covenant keeper. Look at Psalm 105 and verse 42. He remembered His holy promise, and Abraham His servant. He brought out His people with joy, His chosen ones with gladness. He gave them the lands of the Gentiles, and they inherited the labor of the nations. So the covenant was, that's the part of it that's mentioned here, He's going to give them the land, and then what's stated is, He gave them the land. Right? So the covenant was made with Abraham, and if you were, you know, just a plain reading of this, and then I were to ask you the question, did God fulfill His covenant to Abraham to give His descendants the land? Yes or no? Did He? From this passage alone, you'd have to affirm, yes, He certainly did. If that's not what's being said, this whole psalm doesn't, you know, God's not a covenant keeper in this psalm. There's no point to it. But that's exactly the point that's being made. It's what this whole psalm is about, as we'll see as we go through it in some detail. Well, of course, the premillennialists, as a key component of premillennialism, which I'm pretty sure most folks in here are aware of some things about that doctrine, key component of that is that God did not fulfill the promise to give Israel the land. And so premillennialists are looking for Israel to go back and inhabit the land and get that land that God never, you know, fully gave them, rebuild the temple, and then Christ is supposed to come there and reign for 1,000 years. That's kind of how the story of premillennialism goes. Let me read to you, I have them on the screen, a couple of quotes from two very leading premillennialists. Charles Ryrie says that the unconditionality of the Abrahamic covenant furnishes an important support for premillennialism. Since the land promise needs a future time, the millennium, in which to be fulfilled. You see what he's saying? That here's a key pillar of premillennialism is this, that this land promise hasn't been fulfilled. And so we need that, you need the millennium to do that. You take that key pillar out of premillennialism and the whole thing's got to fall. Of course, it's got a lot of other pillars that are pretty easy to take out too. But that's a key one. And then you look at what Dwight Pentecost wrote in his book, Things to Come. He says, this Abrahamic covenant, which contained promises of the preservation of a nation and the possession of a land by that nation, was given to a specific covenant people. Since it was unconditional and eternal and has never yet been fulfilled, it must await future fulfillment. So that's about as plain a statement as anybody could ever make, that they believe this land promise was not fulfilled. And again, I say to you, if Psalm 105 has a point, if it's saying anything at all, it's got to be saying that that promise was fulfilled. That's the whole point of this psalm. Now, there are a couple of other passages I want you to be aware of, just as some really good ammunition if you get into a discussion with premillennialists. I think premillennialism is weak on almost every point that it makes, every one of its major points. But this, to me, is extraordinarily weak. I mean, it's just something that's so obvious when you look at what the Scriptures say that they're just completely mistaken about this. And so let me give you a couple of other passages, and a couple of these you're probably aware of. But look at Joshua chapter 21. And verse 43. Joshua 21:43. So the Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it and dwelled in it. The Lord gave them rest all around according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. Not a word failed of any good thing that which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass. Again, I don't know how much plainer anything could possibly be. Here, the writer of Joshua says specifically that what he'd sworn to do to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the fathers, is what he did regarding the land. He fulfilled that promise. And even more to the point, maybe the clearest passage in all of the Bible on it is found actually in the book of Nehemiah, long, long years later. And it's interesting that this is in the book of Nehemiah because, of course, Nehemiah is living in a time when what? They'd inhabited the land for a long time, but they'd been kicked out of it. In fact, Nehemiah was initially not even in the land. And so when you turn over to Nehemiah chapter 9, verses 7 and 8, what's said here is fascinating. You are the Lord God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldeans and gave him the name Abraham. You found his heart faithful before you and made a covenant with him to give him the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, and the Girgashites, to give it to his descendants, and you have performed your words. You know, the premillennialists, if you get in discussion with them, if they really want to continue the argument, they'll say, well, they had the land for a little while, but God kicked them out. Yeah, and here's somebody who experienced God kicking them out, and he still says that God did what he said he was going to do. That's Nehemiah talk. So it's just unconscionable that somebody would come along and say, this promise has not been fulfilled, and build this whole theory up in which millions of people, I mean millions upon millions of people, are trusting in this theory and have it as the basis of their faith, quite frankly. I've been talking to my class at the Bible school about it the last couple of days as we're looking at some of the final chapters in Revelation. And the Left Behind books and movies that have been out, really popularizing all of that. That's what all of that's about, of course. And lots of things in our culture. And, of course, the whole situation with the relationship between the United States and Israel, a lot of that has been motivated over the years by this misguided concept that somehow the Old Testament nation of Israel is going to go back and inhabit all of that land as a fulfillment of divine prophecy. Well, we've seen that all of that has been fulfilled. Y'all have other comments or questions you'd like to add to that? Anybody? All right. Well, let's go look at the psalm itself then. I wanted to bring in those things as some background and sort of an overview also of the main thing that the psalm is saying. The first six verses of Psalm 105 are an exhortation to praise God. And they are, again, very, very similar to Psalm 96. You can almost feel the passion and the wondrous joy in a person's heart, David, as he's writing these words, as he's got to bring the ark back, and the celebration that goes on there. So let's read these first six verses. Give thanks to the Lord. Call upon His name. Make known His deeds among the people. Sing to Him. Sing psalms to Him. Talk of all His wondrous works. Glory in His holy name. Let the hearts of those rejoice who seek the Lord. Seek the Lord and His strength. Seek His face evermore. Remember His marvelous works which He has done, His wonders and the judgments of His mouth. O seed of Abraham, His servant, the children of Jacob, His chosen ones. The psalm encourages us to give thanks to the Lord and in various ways. And again, we notice this in Psalm 96. There's not just one way to show your appreciation to God. There are lots of ways to do that, and there are lots of reasons to do that, as we saw in Psalm 96. One of the things it says to do is to call upon His name. Give thanks to the Lord, call upon His name. In calling upon God's name, we are acknowledging Him as the giver of all good gifts. We are saying God, we are recognizing that You, every good gift comes down from You, and therefore You're the one we're asking for something. You're the one we're calling upon. That acknowledges His greatness and His goodness. And then, so that's one thing you can do, call upon His name. And then it says to sing praises to Him. Of course, this is something we do. Talk of all His wondrous works. We talked about this a good bit Sunday morning and talking about Psalm 96, all of the great things that He's done in the world, all the great things He's doing in our lives, all of the blessings that He has given to us. These are things that need to be on our lips day by day. I appreciated, don't want to embarrass the person, but I noticed a post on Facebook today of somebody who was thanking God for seeing him through his schooling and all that God had done for him and allowing that to happen. That's the kind of thing that we all need to be doing, all of the goodness that God has shown all of us day by day for the things He's doing and His wondrous works. So we make known His deeds, we sing to Him, we talk of His wondrous works, we glory in His name, glory in His holy name. People today talk about having pride in their accomplishments. I'm not really certain. I just have my doubts here, and somebody else might want to throw in on this. I'm not really certain. I know there is a sense in which people say, well, you're supposed to have some pride about you or something like that. I'm not really certain that we should. I'm not certain that the word pride or proud is ever used in a positive way in the Scriptures. In fact, I'm pretty certain that it's not. I can't think of a time. I've thought about it a long time. So, however, whatever it is that we may mean today when we say, I'm proud of you, or something, in a good way, I'm not even totally sure that we should even say that. Because, you know, pride's an insidious thing. And it's, but if we're going to glory, if we're going to boast, if we're going to be lifted up, what's it supposed to be in? Both Old Testament and New Testament say this. In the Lord. In what the Lord has done. If you want to feel that sense of being lifted up, of and exaltation that goes with that, well, think about what the Lord has done and focus on His works. And I, you know, instead of, I try to, I don't always do this, but when I think about it, instead of saying, well, I'm proud of so-and-so, I try to think about it like this. I thank God for so-and-so. Because He's the one who should receive the glory for whatever it is that He's allowed them to accomplish in their lives. And maybe that's not that big a deal, but I think it's just a difference in the way that we see life. We're to glory in His name, in His holy name. We're to rejoice, seek His strength, and seek His face. We talked, when we studied an earlier psalm, Psalm 27, I think, about seeking the face of the Lord. When God's face is on you, what does that mean? Remember us talking about that? You're in His favor. You're in a relationship with You. He's looking at you with Him, and He's looking at you, and He's interested in what's going on in your life, and He's ready to help you out and answer your requests. So seek His face, seek His favor, and remember His works. So all of those things are said in that context. And then in this central part of this psalm, the body of it, if you will, again, is that God kept His covenant with Abraham. Let's look at verses 7 and 8. God's character as a covenant maker. He is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He remembers His covenant forever, the word which He commanded for 1,000 generations. I think a couple of things are being said about the nature of God here. First, that He's a just and righteous God. His judgments are everywhere to be seen. His judgments are in all the earth. And secondly, that He doesn't forget promises that He's made. You ever, maybe you yourself or had dealings with somebody who was good-hearted, very well-intentioned, maybe wanted to help you out and made a promise to you that they were going to do something for you, and time passed and they never did that. Maybe you remind them of it down the road and they just, oh, well, I'm so sorry, I just forgot. You ever had that happen? You ever do that? Most of us as human beings probably have. And that's disappointing because you wonder, well, here's a good-hearted person and they really want to help me, and we sort of had an agreement that they were going to, and then they really did just forget about that. God's not like that. As a covenant keeper, He is completely just and righteous. And He remembers for 1,000 generations. He'll remember that covenant. He's not going to forget it. So that gives us, at the outset, if we're in a covenant relationship with God, automatically, I feel really good about that. Anybody here ever buy anything on eBay online? Raise your hand if you ever bought anything on eBay. Okay, there's a few of us. If you go to buy something online from an eBay seller, there's usually like a number of stars, or there's a rating of the seller, and it'll give you a percentage of people that have had good dealings with them, and then what's left over of that is the percentage of people that haven't had good dealings with that person. So it might be, you know, their 97% satisfaction guarantee or seller or whatever, and or you might have a 80% one, you know. I only like to do dealings with the 100% ones. You know what I mean? I mean, if it doesn't say 100% up there, I'm not going to do a deal with them. I'm not going to buy their thing. So God is 100%er, you know, forever. And so if you're going to get in a covenant with Him, you're going to make an arrangement with Him, that there's something you can really count on. There's something you can really count on. That's what's being said in these couple of verses. And then He goes through, and we read the verses before, and I've talked about this already, the making of the covenant with Abraham, the confirmation of it with Isaac and Jacob, and we read these verses where that was done. What I want to do, though, is go through this text now with you, and just notice in the time we have remaining, just notice what God did. As you read the Old Testament story, and as you cover the material in the Bible classes, look at Bob and Sandra's material and all of that, it's easy as you look through all of that detail and follow the narrative of the story, to see things as just events that are happening, as if it's just a human history that's being told. And one of the things this psalm does for us is it shows us it's not just a human history that's being told. God is in this at every turn. He is working, and this psalm shows us, working to fulfill His covenant at every turn. See if you see that with me as we go through and read some of this, starting in verse 13. Talking about the patriarchs, first of all, he says, they went from one nation to another, from one kingdom to another people. He permitted no one to do them wrong. Yes, He rebuked kings for their sakes, saying, do not touch My anointed ones and do My prophets no harm. Now, somebody remember with Abraham and Isaac especially, some events that fit what's being described here. Where did Abraham and Isaac go, and what kings were they protected from? Y'all remember? Pharaoh, somebody else said the other one I thought of, Abimelech. Yeah, so they're going around, traveling from country to country, down to Egypt, you know, here and there, over to Gerar. And in all of that, you remember the problems that they had, with both those patriarchs had with the kings desiring their wives, and then but God protecting both the patriarch and his wife and all of that. And that's, and as you read that story, you might think, well, that's interesting that God would intervene there to protect, you know, Sarah and Rebecca. But is that all there is to that? What's God really doing? Well, what we're going to see is it's all leading to, yeah, keeping the promise. He's going to protect them and their descendants and their descendants and their descendants until such a time as He brings them to inhabit this land. And so He's not going to let anything happen to them for that exact reason. Look at the next few verses here as we look at verses 16 through 22. Moreover, He called for a famine in the land. He destroyed all the provision of bread. He sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. Now, you remember that. The famine grows great in the land, and so Joseph is sold into slavery. Just prior to that, and it describes in very poetic terms something you don't get when you go through the narrative back in Genesis. They hurt his feet with fetters. He was laid in irons until the time that his word came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. What's he talking about there? Joseph is apparently thrown in prison, and then his word came to pass. The butler and the baker, you remember that? And so then the king sent and released him in verse 20. The ruler of the people let him go free. He made him lord of his house and ruler of all his possessions to bind his princes at his pleasure and teach his elders wisdom. And so again, if you're reading that story in the Old Testament, when we tell it to our children, you may get the mistaken idea that God is all he is doing is intervening here in a single man's life or in the life of this one family, Joseph, and helping Joseph get out of prison because he likes Joseph or something like that. But as you see it as a part of the story that's being told here, you realize God is in the process of fulfilling this covenant. All of this gets back to him keeping his promise about the land. So, then Israel also came into Egypt in verse 23. And Jacob dwelt in the land of Ham. He increased his people greatly and made them stronger than their enemies. Now, who's the he there? God is. God is the one increasing their number, making them stronger than the enemies. And then, verse 25, he turned their heart to hate his people, to deal craftily with his servants. There arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, right? Yeah. And so that occurred. His people began to be hated and enslaved by the Egyptians. All of that is God's doing as well. And then in verse 26, he sent Moses his servant and Aaron, whom he had chosen, and they performed his signs among them and wonders in the land of Ham. He sent darkness and made it dark. And so he goes and talks about the plagues of Egypt, the plague of darkness in verse 28. He turned water to blood in verse 29, killed their fish, brought frogs on the land in verse 30. The swarm of flies, the lice, are mentioned in 31. Hail for rain, flaming fire in their land, struck their vines and their fig trees, splintered the trees of their territory. He spoke the locusts, young locusts without number, ate up all their vegetation, devoured the fruit of their land. He also destroyed all the firstborn in their land, the first of all their strength. Now, as you're reading those plagues back in Genesis, you definitely get the idea that God is certainly doing these things with His mighty hand, and that He's intending for Pharaoh to let his people go. But what you might not realize as you're reading that story is even the bigger picture, that he's doing really all of this to fulfill a promise that he made to Abraham, to get that people out of Egypt to the land where he promised them. And that's the key thing, that he's doing all of that to fulfill this promise. And when he brought them out of the land, how were they set up? They're very wealthy, because they got to take essentially the riches of Egypt with them. And so that's mentioned as well. He also, verse 37, he also brought them out with silver and gold, and there was none feeble among them. Egypt was glad when they departed, for the fear of them had fallen upon them. And of course, certainly initially that was true, and maybe afterwards as well, after what happened at the Red Sea, may have been especially true after that. But Egypt was glad to get rid of them. God arranged all of that. He spread a cloud for a covering and fire to give light in the night. The people asked, and he brought quail and satisfied them with the bread of heaven. He opened the rock, and water rushed out of it and ran in the dry places like a river. So all of those great events and those miracles and God bringing them up out of the land of Egypt, the provision, the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, giving them food, giving them water, taking care of them in every way. And according to what this psalm is telling us, it's all going back to that promise. It's all keeping that covenant about the land. Verse 42, again, he remembered his holy promise and Abraham his servant. And he brought out his people with joy, his chosen ones with gladness. He gave them the lands of the Gentiles, and they inherited the labor of the nations. So, all of that done so that God could remember that promise to Abraham and give them the land that he had promised to give them. It's just really a tremendous story of the faithfulness of God as a promise keeper, as a covenant keeper. And the last thing I think that we probably need to talk about for a few minutes is the very last verse. A couple of things that, getting back to my premillennial friends, that they don't really see. When it talks about God remembering His covenant for 1,000 generations or making a covenant forever and ever, what I think they fail to see is that a covenant is an arrangement between two parties. And on the one side, God is ever faithful to keep His part of the bargain. And it doesn't matter how much time goes by or whatever else, He's going to do what His part of the bargain is. But if somebody doesn't keep their part of the bargain, what about that? It voids the covenant, doesn't it? If the covenant is, it's a conditional covenant. Now, the premillennial people try to say it was an unconditional covenant, but that's not true. Even if you go back to Abraham, there was a sign that was given of the covenant. Abraham was told that he was to teach his children in the ways of God. There were several things that were listed as conditions there. So it was a conditional covenant, and Abraham and his children had to keep those conditions. God was ever faithful on his side, and you see that in this psalm. He did, you know, over and above but it was the descendants of Abraham that didn't keep the covenant, that broke the covenant. And to suggest somehow that God still owes them something, which is what the premillennial people say, that God still owes them the land after their, you know, covenant breakers over and over and over and over and over again, is again just sort of ridiculous. If you make an agreement with a car company to buy a car, and you get the financing through their financing house, and you take the car home and you signed all the papers, and supposedly the car is yours, but you made an agreement to make all these payments, and then about every other payment you skip. After about a year or so, you know, they come and get your car. You don't make payments again for another 10 years, and then you show up at their place one day and say, "Oh, y'all still owe me that car. We had a covenant. We had a deal." That'd just be crazy, wouldn't it? That's what the premillennialists are saying, in essence, about Israel. That they didn't keep their part of the bargain at all, skip payments over and over again, and they went without doing anything for, you know, 1,000 years, and now they can come to God and say, "Oh, you still owe us this land." You know, when God gave them the land to begin with. So it's beyond unreasonable. But what I wanted to get to in verse 45, you see what that says? He did all of this, we've already seen, to keep the promise to Abraham in verse 43. Verse 45 says that they might observe His statutes and keep His laws. Praise the Lord. God's intention was to give them what He promised so that they could do what they promised. That's what He does with us today. He gives us what He promised so that we might do what we promised. We are in a covenant, a new covenant, with our Heavenly Father, who is a covenant keeper. He's gone above and beyond anything that we could possibly imagine or ask, to do His part of the bargain. And what He's asking us to do is keep our part of the bargain. I think there's a great lesson in Psalm 105. I want to thank you all for good attention tonight, and appreciate you trying to follow along as we went through that good psalm. We'll look at Psalm 106. If God is a covenant keeper, Psalm 106 teaches us that man is a covenant breaker. And we'll see that very vividly displayed in the 106th Psalm.